May it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of Earl Forrest, who was sentenced to death. And this morning I would like to focus this court's attention on the first two issues we raised in our brief, and both of them deal with brain damage and what the jury heard and what the jury did not hear about brain damage. It's really critical in this case. The first issue revolves around whether counsel was ineffective for failing to get a PET scan, a brain scan. And then the second issue deals with medical records that my client had been treated more than 10 years earlier before the crime for a head injury. He had a 7 to 9 inch centimeter, and I looked it up on my ruler yesterday, and I almost brought the ruler because that's pretty big. It's about 3.5 inches. And the second issue deals with those medical records that dealt with those as well as some other mental health issues. But first, the PET scan. You know, this is an interesting case because the state, Mr. Austin's at the trial, made such a big issue out of the lack of objective data to support our experts' conclusions that there was brain damage. I don't think there could be any dispute about that, really, that this was a hotly contested issue. I mean, he was perfectly entitled to do what he did, but it was certainly contested at every turn in both the guilt and penalty phase with all three experts. On cross-examination, can you show us an x-ray or anything, a scan that was done?
Of course, counsel had to make the decision prior to trial without knowing what Mr. Austin would do as to whether or not to get the PET scan, and counsel said at the hearing that counsel was concerned it might not show any brain damage and that that could then be used strongly against his client. And so how do you, after the fact, one would make a different determination, but that's not how we look at it.
No, I think you look at counsel's actions at the time in preparing for the trial. And I really do think her actions speak louder than her words in this case. I think she gave a lot of rationales for why she didn't get the scan done, one being that it might come back bad. One being that the state might learn about it because of this court's decision in State versus Anderson, ex parte order wouldn't be allowed and she'd have to get a transportation order. One being that jurors don't really find these that, you know, impressive. I mean, there were some statements.
And isn't it the role of the motion court to rule on whether it found persuasive her statements versus her actions, as opposed to us substituting our judgment for the motion?
Exactly.
Court.
And so you have to look at those statements and say, are those reasonable or are they refuted by the record? And that's where I get into her actions really do speak louder than her words.
Isn't that the role? I mean, we don't substitute our decision for the trial court as to whether it found her statements believable versus her statements in conflict with others.
I think this court applies a clearly erroneous standard, and then you have to look if the most important findings are refuted by the record. And what I'm trying to say is the record shows that she made other statements, and she said, okay, I really did want the scan. I mean, that is why her two experts recommended she get the scan. The neuropsychologist, and if you look at her memos, and when she was confronted with her memos that she had done before trial, before any of this came up, it said in May of 2003 they discussed getting brain scans and wanting to do that. And then in June of 2004, Dr. Evans said, I think you should get a PET scan. I think it would show brain damage. That was important, and if you look at the memos of the trial attorneys, they said that was important and that we need to follow up, we need to do this. If she didn't want a scan because she didn't think it would be that helpful or she didn't think or it might turn out bad, why did she 2 weeks before trial have another attorney contact an expert and say, try to get the scan arranged? And then she testified, despite all those statements that I've just recounted, she testified, Yes, if Dr. Smith would have ordered the PET scan 2 weeks before trial, I would have had it done. And no one explains, counsel does not explain, the state does not explain, how she could have had Dr. Smith at St. Louis University do the scan without transporting the client there. The transportation order was going to be an issue no matter which doctor did the scan. It just was. I mean, this is not a kind of scan you can have at the jail. He had to be transported to where the equipment was. So why? What I'm saying, Your Honor, is when you look at the entire record, her action shows she really did want the scan. And those are post hoc rationalizations of, well, we ran out of time and I didn't get it, but it was okay because...
There was something that happened, though, and was it Dr. Smith who said, I won't do the scan?
Exactly. 2 weeks before trial, he was called and asked if he would do the scan, and he said, no, I don't think it's medically necessary, quote, unquote. Now, medically necessary isn't the standard for defense counsel in investigating and presenting mitigating evidence. I think
Didn't Dr. Smith really say that he would want an MRI, and then depending upon the results of the MRI, that he would order a PET scan?
He said both things, Your Honor. Yes, he did say, I would do an MRI first, and then I would, you know, do the PET scan if the MRI showed something. And counsel said, I didn't want to get the MRI because her experts were saying to her the PET scan was the appropriate brain scan to get.
Isn't there also expert belief that the PET scan really can't predict future criminal behavior, and it can't be determinative of a person's state of the mind in the past? And so regardless of all this, where is your Strickland prejudice?
I think under Chouinard, the United States Supreme Court, and this court's decision in Hutchinson, have talked about borderline intellectual functioning, limited intellectual functioning, and how that doesn't have to be tied to the crime itself. It doesn't have to be tied to future behavior. This court said in Hutchinson there are virtually no limits placed on the type of mitigating evidence that can be presented. And specifically, brain damage would go to intellectual functioning, certainly. And so even if you can't tie that, and the United States Supreme Court in Chouinard said it would be unconstitutional to limit mitigation to that that could be tied to causing the crime. So I don't think there's any issue.
But this isn't a question of whether the court refused to let them do it. She made a strategy decision, and if in fact, you know, she believed it was not directly relevant, it couldn't prove causation or disprove causation, wouldn't that, she had many choices. You can only put on so much mitigation evidence. Doesn't it make your argument harder to show that this was prejudicial? Because obviously you have to pick and choose what mitigation to put on. The state can't choose it for you. But you're not going to put on, there's a limit. At some point it may be counterproductive.
There's a limit, I guess, if you're putting on the same type of evidence, okay? So if our claim was, oh, she should have called another expert who would have testified about the same things that the three hired experts she called testified. There was no evidence, and Mr. Austin's drove this point home over and over and over, that there was no objective data, Your Honor. There's no brain scans at all. There's nothing, he said to the jury, is there anything the jury can look at and see that this man's brain is damaged? No. There were no medical records introduced that showed he, in fact, had head injuries. And, you know, the court is kind of in a unique position on prejudice in this case because we had a jury foreman who actually just voluntarily talked to the press and said, we didn't buy the brain damage. We didn't buy that. They bought Mr. Austin's argument. And the problem with that is we're not saying, you know, this could never be enough, what she did. If that's all available, that's the test. Was it reasonably available? But when your own experts are saying to you, please get a PET scan, that will confirm it, that will show it, it's more sophisticated. When you have medical records that show he has this head injury, that the expert testifies at trial to the jury, oh, this was just self-reported, and I don't know if it's true. And, of course, Mr. Austin's is there saying, of course he's exaggerating it. The problem in this case is that the jury never heard the truth. They never heard the objective evidence that supported the expert's testimony.
Could I clarify one thing in response to Judge Russell's question? My reading of your points relied on is that you are only claiming counsel was ineffective in failing to obtain this information and presenting it in the penalty phase, in the mitigating evidence. And I, because it doesn't say anything about the guilt phase and the impact of the evidence in the guilt phase. And I'm assuming that's because of recognition of Judge Russell's statement that there is evidence out there that it isn't. What that shows on a PET scan is not utilized to diagnose a medical condition and tied to a particular behavior.
That is true as to the medical records point, the point number two. But as to the PET scan, it was pled in the motion court, and I think we presented it, that Dr. Smith did testify in guilt phase about brain damage and about how that impaired his ability to deliberate. So we have argued and we have presented it, or we tried to present it, as to guilt phase as to the PET scan, but not to the medical records.
Because I read it as saying he was prejudiced because if they obtained it, it would have shown damage. Had they heard this, a reasonable probability exists they would have imposed a life sentence. So it doesn't say a reasonable probability exists they would have found him not guilty or guilty of a lesser included offense.
And that is not detailed in there, and if that's inefficient, if that's not sufficient, that's my fault. But it is certainly in the argument, and then in the reply we discussed the U.S. versus Perkey case that dealt with that issue directly, where the Eighth Circuit talked about whether a PET scan can come in guilt phase. And in that case, the court said, as Judge Russell points out, not by itself. It's not freestanding. It doesn't prove a mental state. It doesn't prove a mental disease or defect. You have to have something to tie it to that. And in our case, we had Dr. Smith, who testified in the guilt phase and would have tied it to it. He says he testified in the post-conviction hearing that he would have relied on it and he would have used it. And we have discussed the Rain case and the Windmiller case, I think one's a Western District case and one's an Eastern District case, that talks about the importance of the defense being allowed to present corroborating evidence, factual support for your mental disease or defect. And I think that's what the PET scan would have done. It just would have provided support for Dr. Smith's testimony, so the jury would have known.
Was it Dr. Smith?
Dr. Smith. It was Dr. Robert Smith in the guilt phase. And he then testified against him again in the penalty phase. And then you had also Dr. Gelbord, who was the neuropsychologist.
So it was the same doctor who refused or who said he didn't want to do the PET scan that you're relying on to say he should.
No,
have.
There were two Dr.
Two
Smiths.
Dr.
I'm sorry. That's what's okay. Confusing. Dr. Robert Smith was the doctor who testified at trial in both guilt and penalty. And Dr. Ken Smith was the doctor. He was a neurologist from St. Louis University.
Thank you.
And
that.
He only came up in the post-conviction action. So I think the critical issue is if you look at all the evidence, not just selected portions, and I think when this court engages in the proper standard of review, it reviews the entire record to see if a mistake has been made. And I think when you review the entire record, you will see that counsel really wanted this PET scan done. It's just that they waited too long and it was last minute and they couldn't arrange it in time to get it done and presented. The second issue goes, and I think it's a little easier in some ways, because counsel indicates that when Dr. Gelbord testified about the brain injury, she said, I should have corrected him. I should have said, you know, but you had the records. It showed that he actually was treated for this brain injury, and she didn't do that. And I think that was ineffective because, once again, the prosecutor argued over and over and over that there was no evidence, there was no objective account of this brain damage. Plus, those records would have shown depression and alcohol and substance abuse, dependence, the very exact diagnoses that these hired doctors were giving at trial. And as this court said in Hutchinson, records are so important so that the jury knows it's not just a made-up defense shortly before trial, that it actually happened. It actually occurred 10 to 13 years before trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. In this case, Mr. Forrest contends counsel was ineffective for not ordering the PET scan. The motion court found otherwise. The motion court found Sharon Turlington's reasons for not ordering that scan credible. The motion court found that they were reasonable. Ms. Turlington, upon trying to arrange for the scan, after her experts told her that it would be useful, tried to do it at St. Louis University, which she judged to be a convenient place, and the doctor there would not do it without first performing an MRI. Ms. Turlington did not want to perform an MRI because she was concerned that it would come out negative, the state would be able to get it, and the state would be able to use it against her at trial, and which she thought would be devastating.
Because an MRI doesn't show structural damage, right?
That's correct. Okay. And she believed that the state could show the MRI and draw an inference the other way. And she did not want that to come out. She also didn't want the state to know what tests they were conducting on Mr. Forrest, which she would have had to do if she would have filed a motion to transport Mr. Forrest to have these tests done.
Is that inconsistent with her asking this Dr. Smith to do the test 2 weeks before trial? So she must have waited and decided she wanted the test.
There's also evidence in the record that she didn't find that before September the experts hadn't discussed fully with her getting the test. In other words, when her experts told her, she began to investigate getting the test done. So counsel only at that point realized that the experts would find this helpful. That's when they asked her. She began the process of doing it, and eventually she decided
not to do it. And was it incompetent to wait that long to figure that out?
If the experts don't tell her before then what tests they would like, I don't think that counsel's expected to figure out for her experts what medical tests they think would be helpful. I mean, that's why she hires the experts.
Your opponent argues that if Dr. Smith indicated that he wouldn't perform it, that she had the option of just not accepting that and having to run the MRI, but to check with some other doctor who performs the PET scans to obtain the PET scan from the other doctor.
And at that point, counsel determined, I just don't have the time with the case I have to present to go find another doctor. I've already taken the time working with this one, and counsel reasonably decided not to go down that path, especially considering that all three of her experts would testify without the PET scan, this man has frontal lobe damage, and they all did.
Do you agree, though, that the prosecutor used that against them effectively?
The prosecutor did use that fact against them, but if the PET scan would have been put in at trial, there was ample ground for the prosecutor to use that against them as well by pointing out that there is no definitive connection between the PET scan results and any psychological condition.
Isn't that contrary to what he was arguing? He, in effect, said, well, there would have been, but they didn't show it, so it must not exist. I mean,
well,
he kind of argued something that he knows wasn't, in fact, a connection.
If he argued that at trial that there is no objective evidence. If the PET scan would have come in, the argument would have been, they have this PET scan, but what does it really show? There's no connection between the PET scan results and any diagnosis of any mental condition.
Because you can never have objective evidence.
You can never have objective medical evidence of a psychological condition, and all of the doctors admitted that in the PCR hearing.
So it was a disingenuous argument by the prosecutor in the first instance.
I think it was an argument made, and Dr. Gelbort talked about scans on direct examination from Forrest Counsel about scans not being able to show this. They would be helpful but not necessary.
The fact that there is no medical testimony that connects the results of a PET scan to particular behavior is a significant or effective argument in the guilt phase, but much less significant in the penalty phase, isn't it? Because the mere fact that there is brain damage, can that be mitigating or not?
It can be mitigating. He presented three experts testifying he had brain damage, that he had frontal lobe damage. And the experts,
I mean, the PET scan would have shown that, whether or not it's related to deliberation. Would have confirmed he had brain damage.
It would have confirmed that he had decreased electrical impulse functioning in the frontal lobes. And Dr. Preston said that was as far as he could go with the analysis of the PET scan. They couldn't have connected it to definitively to any condition that Mr. Forrest suffers from. In other words, all it would have shown was a decreased level of electrical functioning. As to whether that means he couldn't deliberate, they can't do that.
Well, that wasn't or the issue. But I thought your argument was that it doesn't show the cause of the brain damage, that he did have brain damage, but it could have been from his drug use and not from prior abuse.
Yes, and it could have showed both those things also. And it simply shows the physical state of his brain, but not where it came from, what effect it has on him, any of those things. The effects that the brain damage would have had on him come from the psychologist, the neuropsychologist, both of which testified in the penalty phase about the effects of the frontal lobe damage on Mr. Forrest. And Dr. Preston couldn't have added anything to their testimony. They both testified that Mr. Forrest had significant mental defects. And that testimony is what it is.
And he was of average intelligence, is that correct?
I believe so, yes. There was no showing he was retarded or anything else of that nature.
So this evidence would have been cumulative and not mitigation friendly?
The PET scan? I think it would have been cumulative.
How can it be cumulative when counsel berated him for not having it? When Mr. Austin said you failed to give any objective evidence, whether or not it's prejudicial is a different issue, but certainly having medical records of something is not cumulative to having someone testify and be cross-examined and say you didn't have any medical records proving this, did you? And they couldn't.
I assume we're talking about the PET scan here.
Yes.
Still. Okay.
There's no objective evidence of brain damage, and that was criticized for that. So having objective evidence could not be cumulative to witness testimony that was not objective.
And I would argue it was cumulative, because all it would have gone to show is that there's a problem in his frontal lobes, and all of the doctors said that there was. But even passing the fact, even putting the cumulative question aside, there simply wasn't prejudice, because all the doctors said that there is a problem in his frontal lobes.
Do you concede it would be admissible, at least in the mitigation
phase? In the penalty phase?
Yes,
it would have been admissible in the penalty phase. Moving on to this issue about the Valley View Memorial Hospital records, here counsel David Kenyon testified that he did not want those records admitted at trial. The reason for the baseball bat injury, which he did not want to get into, involved violence. It involved Forrest selling drugs. And both of those things he did not want the jury to hear about.
Could he have presented the evidence and asked the court to redact any portion that was not relevant to the mental condition?
I think once he introduces evidence that he was hit over the head with a baseball bat, the state is entitled to discuss how that injury occurred.
And why? What relevance does that?
I think it brings into relevance in penalty phase, which is where this would have been offered, that as to Forrest's character, how the injuries were occurring to him. Did it come from a car crash? In other words, it allows for full consideration of Mr. Forrest's life and his past. And counsel did not want anything to come in to suggest that Forrest was selling drugs or that he had been involved in violent incidents involving drugs.
Because it could have come from an abusive parent, and that would have been in his favor.
That's correct. So all of these, counsel wanted to make sure that this didn't come in a way that was going to harm their client. And here, so counsel decided not to put this in. Now, in terms of these medical records showing drug and alcohol abuse, heavens, there was plenty of evidence of drug and alcohol abuse in this record, dating back decades, and Mr. Forrest's brother testified to that, as did nearly every other witness he called. simply there was the one incident where he got hit over the head with a baseball bat. Simply, there's no reasonable probability that had the jury heard that, they would have come to a different conclusion here. It's just not, in terms of the evidence in the case presented, and in terms of the mental health testimony that Forrest presented, it just wasn't going to change the jury's verdict here.
Was there something in the medical records and in the testimony that indicated that it was not simply an injury, but that it was an injury that left residual damage?
There was nothing that would have connected it.
That wasn't in the medical records, and the only potential for that was in the PET scan.
What I believe that Mr. Forrest is trying to do is argue that getting hit by the baseball bat caused the injury, which is going to be mitigating because he's really not in control of his actions.
That's what I was wondering. Was there something that connected the 1990 baseball bat injury with an continuing damage in 2002?
There's really no evidence that that was the source of the damage. Dr. Preston opines it might be. He also says that the brain damage could have come from drug use, from other factors such as that. But there's no evidence tying the baseball bat injury directly to the brain scan results and to any deficiencies Forrest had. And the California medical records also show merely that he had depression, that he had alcohol and substance abuse, neither of which are caused by a baseball bat injury, and both of which Dr. Robert Smith testified that Forrest suffered from at trial. And counsel reasonably chose not to present those records, and even if counsel's decision was unreasonable, there simply isn't prejudice under the facts of this case. And if there are no other questions, I would ask this court to affirm the Platte County Circuit Court's judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. As to the medical records, I just want to clear up a few things. First, in Exhibit 11, it's a small amount of medical records. I know in death penalty cases you often see, you know, tombs and tombs, but it's fairly small, actually. And those medical records don't say anything about how this incident occurred at all. But interestingly enough, Dr. Gelbort's report provided to the prosecutor, and he testified and could have been crossed on that extensively, does go into great detail about this baseball bat incident. And that was open, wide open for the state and for cross-examination. In fact, I think your first few lines of the report says, Mr. Forrest reports he is hit with a baseball bat, apparently mugged and jumped while he was entering a hotel room. It was open. The records added nothing except objective medical evidence, a third account by an emergency room doctor that he actually had a 7 to 9 centimeter injury and was treated for that. They had a significant hematoma, that he had headaches as a result of that. Now, what Dr. Preston does then is talk about that's consistent with the kind of damage he saw on the PET scan. But no, he cannot say, did that cause all of this damage in and of itself? It is one, it could be, it's consistent with. So I think that was important, and I think this whole business about it opening the door, it is not reasonable because the door had already been opened. And actually, Sharon Turlington testified it was a mistake not to correct Dr. Gelbort. And when he said, all I have is a self-report, she admitted that. She could have easily referred to the records and have done that.
Could you clarify one other additional thing about the record? What did Dr. Preston say about the long history of abuse of alcohol and drugs as far as resulting in the PET scan result versus the baseball bat?
I think the drug and alcohol would cause damage to a lot of areas of the brain. And what he said was this baseball bat injury would have caused, I guess when you're hit in the head, the injury doesn't just occur where you're hit, but where it knocks your brain into the, and so it was very consistent with this frontal lobe damage that he had seen, and he said it was consistent with that. And I would note that the motion court did find Dr. Preston very credible. He specifically made that finding that he was a very credible witness, and he is. I mean, his CV is pretty amazing, especially because, I mean, a lot of these doctors in these cases, you just get the sense, oh, they're, like Mr. Austin said, they're a hired gun. This is a fellow who is at KU, has done nuclear medicine, has used nuclear medicine to diagnose a lot of cancers, Alzheimer's, a lot of medical problems, and it just had such a ring of objectivity and truthfulness to it that the jury didn't hear anything about. And I really do think there are two issues here, and we're kind of blending the two. One is the cumulativeness, and one is the prejudice. And I think unquestionably it's not cumulative. I mean, you cannot look at this record and find anything like a PET scan presented. You find no medical records presented, and that's what the prosecutor said you don't have. And it's an issue in dispute. It wasn't conceded. Everyone conceded Earl Forrest used alcohol and drugs. So if we would have been saying, oh, counsel should have got a blood alcohol content test to show his, you know, alcohol use at the time of the crime, that would have been cumulative. There's no question. That was conceded by the state. It was conceded by the defense. That was not in dispute. The harder issue is the prejudice. You know, the harder issue is, would this made of a difference in this case? And that's what worries me. You know, Mr. Forrest killed three people, and that's hard, you know. But in Taylor versus State, just this last year, this court talked about we don't have an automatic death penalty in this state. It would be unconstitutional. And you really don't know what mitigation is going to be the basis for a sentence less than death. And I would ask this court, in a case where there was objective evidence available that would have shown the brain damage that counsel wanted the jury to hear and believe, that it should have been presented. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That case is submitted.